way to do this. Let me show you a better way. You don't have to be another.
Well, hi folks, this is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, May the 7th, 2006. That means it's time for our show of the week with the Expert Council. And I've got a good lineup for you guys today, a good diverse lineup too, not just of council members, but topics. Dr. Ron Paul and Chris Rossini are going to talk about a simple question. If the ships are being able to move through the strait, why are they pausing Project Freedom, which was designed to keep ships moving through the strait? We'll see what they have to say about that, and I'll have my add-on thoughts with it as always. Mike Melito will talk about hunting turkey for the everyday hunter, and I guess a phenomenon going on in turkey hunting that I wasn't aware of. Apparently it's become this big honking thing that only special people can do and you need lots of money to do, or so it's a bird. It can be challenging, and he'll talk about that, but it certainly doesn't have to be expensive or out of the reach of the everyday blue-collar hunter. Nick Ferguson will talk about something called ship mast locust, which is just basically a specific, I wouldn't even say variety, let's say genetic line of black locust. Doc Bones will talk about who Michael Faraday was, beyond the Faraday cage, and why every prepper should know about Michael Faraday. Then we're talking about dealing with a dog who's got great obedience at home with its handler when nothing else is going around. But take it to the park, let it see a squirrel or another dog, take it to a public location with a bunch of people milling around, all of a sudden the dog loses its discipline. What do we do to fix that? And Jesse Markowitz will talk to you about why your Bitcoin is not in your Bitcoin wallet. I've talked about this before, but it's a good one to revisit. It's actually more important than I think a lot of people realize to contextually understand what it means to say that I own Bitcoin. When you say that, what you're really saying is I control a specific amount of Bitcoin. That's what you're really saying. It'll make sense when Jesse explains it, and I'll add on to it. And then I got an interesting question, one I really never even thought about answering or talking about the subject much at all. And that is, why do I use Telegram for educational programs like our ChatGPT course for solopreneurs? This is actually going to start on Monday if you signed up. If you're one of the people that got one of the 100 seats in the class, that class you signed up for on this Monday will actually start the coming Monday. And we use Telegram for it. And this person is setting up some educational programs of their own, wants to know if they should use it. And I really can't tell somebody if they should use it. What I can tell you is how we use it, why we use it, and the type of class I would use it for, and the type of class I would not use it for. And then with that, maybe you can figure out if it works for you. And who knows, maybe this will spawn some other ideas for businesses or entrepreneurial things or other educational programs. Because one of the things I truly believe, and I've tried to teach now for about 18 years, is that the number one thing a person can do for individual liberty is own and operate a successful business. Now, the successful part is important, but every successful business starts out first as an idea, then is just putting something into the world, and then it has failures before it becomes a success. So you have to go through that process. But if you get through it, there's a reason that if I really want to, and something happens, and something's going on in, oh, I don't know, that I really want to go to, and it's in Idaho in September, I can go. I can go. And when I go to events that are part of this community or extended communities, like I was just up at LFTN, Nicole Sauce's event up in Tennessee a couple weeks ago, I'll bet you more than half of the people who have the money and the time to pay to go to something like that and then be there for 4 or 5 days and gain from that experience all the wonderful things, I bet you at least half of those people run their own business. And almost every single person that is presenting at events like that owns and operates their own business. And it is not like, hey, there's something wrong with you if you don't. I'm just pointing out, the same way I would point out, like, if you have $10 million, you can pretty much live the rest of your life and not have to work. That's a statement of fact. It doesn't mean you're a bad person if you have no million dollars, right? It just means that this is a goal that if you achieve it, it gives you this certain amount of autonomy and freedom. A business that can cash flow for you, even when you're not directly putting effort into it, can be as good or better than $10 million, even if it doesn't do anywhere near that amount of money. Ask yourself, if I had $5 million, $10 million, whatever million dollars it was, how much would I pay myself out of it annually so that I never ran out of it and I left it behind for my heirs? A business that can pay out that much without, you know, 24/7, 365 management, it gives you a lot of the same features in your life. Not all the same, but a lot of the same. And so I love talking about things that inspire people to become as independent as possible, whether it's side hustles that let you lay up more cash and retire early, or full-on operational businesses. And so sometimes it's not like, hey, go start a business and do this. It's like, here's a thing that I use in my business. And somebody looks at that thing and says, well, Jack's a dumbass. I can think of things to do with that he never thought of. I'm going to prove it and go do it. I love it when that happens. I love that. I got a really great email just today about a very successful business developed out of this community, along with the fact that AI was a big part of it and our AI course was a part of it. Maybe I'll talk about that particular email next week, because that's not our subject today in my anchor segment. With that, let's go ahead and drop on and hear, and I haven't heard this yet. I didn't pre-screen this. I'm going to listen to it with y'all. Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini talking about Project Freedom and why we're pausing that if it's working, quote unquote.
But, you know, one of the things we find that often happens, as we've done so many of these shows every day, is oftentimes we're ahead of the curve on things. If you put up that first clip, this was 2 days ago. This is on Monday. Our show on Monday was called, Is Project Freedom Just Another Trump Scam? Well, it turns out that yes, it was, because if you go to the next one, as you point out, Trump says the U.S. military operation to guide ships out of the Strait of Hormuz is paused. Paused. They paused Project Freedom 2 days after they launched it. And one of the things I mentioned in my speech at our conference is there's a pattern of market manipulation with Trump. There's a Friday, things are going well, then over the weekend I'm going to blow the blank out of you, and then on Monday morning another manipulation, things are going well. Well, this is the case with Project Freedom. On Monday morning, Trump came out, the Straits of Hormuz are now open, we are guiding ships through, Project Freedom is going to get the ships through. Well, not a single ship emerged unscathed through a very dangerous rocky crossing near the Strait of Oman, through the Strait of Hormuz, before he called it off. And here's what he said. If you go to the next one. Based on the request of Pakistan and other countries, the tremendous military success that we have had during the campaign against the country of Iran, and additionally the fact that great progress has been made toward a complete and final agreement with representatives of Iran, we have mutually agreed that while the blockade will remain in full force and effect, Project Freedom, the movement of ships through the Strait of Hormuz, will be paused for a short period of time to see whether or not the agreement can be finalized and signed. Literally nothing in this post, Dr. Paul, is true. Nothing he says here is true. There was no mutual agreement. The ships weren't going through the strait. And if the ships were going through, then why would they pause it? Because that would help the world economy. If ships were moving through and everything was as fine as President Trump says, it would be a great success. Why would you pause a great success and move things back to how it was before? So it's just completely insane, Dr. Paul.
Marco Rubio says, the goal of the war in Iran is now to restore it back to the way it was. And what? Before we started the war.
Before we started the war.
And if you suggested to it, bring the troops home, you've committed treason.
Yeah.
You can't do that. Desert your military and this sort of thing.
On the one hand, we all hate the media. The mainstream media has done a terrible job. But Despite that, what this administration has done is kicked out every serious reporter, even if some of them are bad. They've kicked out every serious reporter from these press conferences, and you have it full of sycophants. So we have, on the one hand, Rubio is saying this, which is an important thing. You want a reporter there to challenge him. Do you mean, Mr. Secretary, that going back to the status quo before you messed up the status quo is our goal? But nobody was there to do that. Instead, when he gave that same press conference, one of the questions to Mr. Rubio was, what is your DJ name? You know, it's absolutely ridiculous and sycophantic. So it's a real problem we have. That's why we're not getting any news. Because even as flawed as those reporters were, at least they played a little bit of the role that the Fourth Estate should play in our society.
So I really don't have a lot to add here. I don't really claim to know what exactly is going on right now in this conflict. But I also know from experience, and I mean from some direct experience, and some of you know what I'm talking about, that you cannot judge anything Trump says as to taking it literally when he says it. That there is always a strategy behind what looks like insanity. And I'm not saying that that means the strategy is good. I'm just saying the strategy is never what you think it is. And that is part of the strategy in of itself. And you cannot analyze the geopolitical situation right now because Trump is the president of the United States, unless you have read The Art of the Deal. And if you have not read The Art of the Deal, I don't care how much you love or hate, despise, don't care about whatever it is Trump, if you actually want to be able to, for the next 3 years anyway, because he ain't going nowhere, you ain't impeaching him, it ain't happening, give up already. For the next 3 years, if you really want, or 2.5, if you want to really understand geopolitics, because the United States is involved in all geopolitics, you have to understand The Art of the Deal and the mindset of the man who is pulling all the strings, or you will never understand what is going on. And I think a lot of people that are critical of literally everything the man says or does have not read that book. I'm just saying. And again, that doesn't mean you're going to all of a sudden become a fan, because I'm not. It does mean that you'll at least have a better understanding of what's going on. With that, let's talk about something totally different. Let's talk turkey for a bit. I don't know if you know this, if you're not a hunter or not a hunter that's ever hunted turkey before, but turkey generally in the United States has two seasons, a fall and a spring. And right now in a lot of the country, it's the time of the year for what's known as spring gobbler season, meaning most of the places I know of anyway, in the spring, you can shoot gobblers or even jakes, birds that are clearly male. And in the fall, you can take a gobbler or a hen, and then the limits are based on where you're at. And so this is a really interesting time of year, because growing up, we always went turkey hunting in the spring. And it was literally, you know, other than like shooting groundhogs or something, the only thing that you could hunt until you got back into fall again. And so we put a lot of effort into it. I will admit, Mike said, I hope you get a turkey this year. I haven't gone turkey hunting, especially spring turkey hunting, since I was a teenager. It just isn't a thing that I make the time to do. I don't make enough time as it is to go do things like this, but if I'm going to, it's not high on my priority list. But it has a lot to do with where I live and access to land. In a lot of the country, there's a lot of public land available, and I did not know that turkey hunting somehow had been elevated into this specialized, highly difficult thing to do. Mike even compares it to like hunting elk or something. I had no idea. So let's listen to Mike, and then maybe I'll have a few thoughts before we move on to the next one.
Turkey hunting made easy. Hey TSP, that's what we're going to talk about today. Why? Two main reasons. It's turkey hunting season in much of the country, and it seems like turkey has become the new elk. What I mean by that is, much like people will convince you, you got to have a tens of thousands of dollar quad or side by side, a giant rifle with a giant OB scope on top that is good to 1,000 yards, and the latest Gucci camouflage pattern, and laser rangefinders and high BC bullets to kill elk, etc., etc. You actually don't. You don't need that stuff. Much the same way that's crept into turkey hunting. I'm not saying turkey hunting can't be challenging. But here's the truth. Growing up, I remember seeing my first turkeys, and I was in high school. Turkeys were extirpated in much of their range in the United States. Now, that's multifaceted, but a lot of that, those turkeys were taken with regular old shotguns, the regular old lead shot. Shows you that that's effective. Long before there was camo that was commonly worn. But you don't need the specialized turkey shotgun with the Gucci camouflage pattern and the extra super mega full turkey choke and the TSX rounds, which are like $70 to $100 a box. Not a box of 25, but a box of 5. Like $15 to $20 plus dollars a shot, a shell. Don't need boots with camo pattern soles. Don't need your first trendy this year Mossy Oak Bottomland to match your Mossy Oak Bottomland shotgun. You don't need a whole spread of decoys. Now, if you want, if that's just your passion and you love turkey hunting and you want to spend that money on it, by all means, it's better than sitting at home watching Netflix and drinking a Diet Coke. But don't think that you need that. Turkey hunting made easy. Take your shotgun. Most modern shotguns are going to come with a improved cylinder, modified, and full choke. Take your full choke. Lead number sixes have been killing turkeys a long time. Just regular lead number sixes. I don't care if it's Federal, Winchester, Remington. Maybe buy a box of each and see what pattern's best out of your shotgun. The full choke, maybe start at 30, 35 yards and keep walking back until you can no longer get consistent kill shots on a turkey-sized head target. Once you've achieved that distance, just remember that distance. That is your distance for shooting turkey. If you have a shotgun with full choke and sights, like proper rifle sights or a red dot, I would go with that. If you just have a bead, that's fine too. One thing to caution though, unlike shooting birds on the wing where you throw the shotgun up into your shoulder and get a natural kind of point shooting technique, wing shooting technique, turkey hunting is not like that. Turkey hunting is more like taking a hostage shot with a rifle, but with a shotgun. You might have that gun in your shoulder for a while, and you have the tendency to kind of creep up with your head to look over the gun, which can make you shoot over the bird. So just be mindful of that if you are using just a vent rib or a bead. But it certainly can be done, and many turkey have gone down with just a beaded regular shotgun. You don't need a specialty shotgun. Turkeys do have good eyesight, although don't need camo. It's helpful. It doesn't really matter. I know this is going to fly in the face of the big camo conspiracy. It doesn't really matter if it's Mossy Oak Bottomland or Real Tree or whatever's the hot in thing right now, the Gucci Flage du jour. A camo pattern. Turkeys do have good eyesight. What's more important than the camo is sitting still. Which leads me to my next point. For much of the country, insects, ticks, jiggers, mosquitoes, at the very least, it's going to make it hard for you to sit still if you've got swarming mosquitoes. At worst, or almost worst, you bag your turkey and you get Lyme disease. That's not a good trade-off. So permethrin is your friend. Permethrin, don't spray it on you. It's not that kind of bug spray, but permethrin, you spray it on your clothes, you hang your clothes out to dry, you put on your clothes, it lasts for several months. We use it in the military. Permethrin is really, really good. It's going to be your best friend sometimes in nasty, wet environments, especially in the springtime where bugs can be worse than at other times of the year. So permethrin, maybe a head net, depending on how bad the mosquitoes are. And again, if you want to get decoys, you can. You don't need them. A tip is just listen for where the turkeys fly down out of roost. Try and listen for the direction they're going and set up an ambush. Bushwhack them. It's an effective technique that's a lot cheaper. I'm not saying it's just as good as, but it's a lot lower barrier to entry. Listen for where they fly out of the roost. Listen for what direction you think they're going and try and set up so they walk in front of you. Again, it can be tricky, but it can be done. So if you are falling into the trap that you need a specialty shotgun and you need a super mega extra full choke and the TSS $20 a shot shell rounds and a full spread of decoys. Again, if you want to go that route, knock yourself out if you're really passionate about it. But if you just want to go out and get a turkey, don't let that stuff stop you. Shotgun, full choke, pattern it. Any kind of camo, sit still, be safe and have fun. Don't overcomplicate it. That's about it, guys. I hope Jack has something to add on turkey hunting. I'd love to hear his thoughts. Thanks, TSP, and have a blessed day.
So I'll say back when we used to hunt turkey in the spring, when I was a kid, we did tend to use number six shot, just like Mike said. We always used full choke, especially, you know, in the spring when you're calling. Sometimes when we would hunt in the fall, I mean, you might just set up because you had overlapping seasons and you were really out for something like small game, but then you broke up a flock or something. But we used number six shot, full choke shotguns. I had an 870 pump shotgun. Even back then, had a rem choke system where you could take the choke tubes out and just switch, like you said. I used pretty much improved cylinder 99% of the time, sometimes go into a modified with duck hunting. But we would use the copper-plated buffered number sixes. We did that mainly because the places that we hunted ducks and other waterfowl were not what were considered to be steel shot only, so we didn't have to use steel shot there. So some places where you hunt waterfowl, they have steel shot regulations because they worry about lead in the aquatic system. So where we hunted, we didn't have to do that. So we ran these. I think Remington made them. You know, they were a 2 3/4 inch or 3 inch shell, depending on what we were doing and what gun you're using. And they were copper plated number sixes. And that's what we used for ducks. I don't even really know why. I mean, when you're a kid and you hunt with your uncle, you use what they say. And so we just used the same rounds. Like, so it wasn't like they were turkey rounds. They were just the rounds that we always had that were good for turkeys. I do want to talk a little bit about why it's gotten this way with turkey hunting, though. Depending on where you are and how much hunting pressure there is, the exact same species of turkey, because there's four like subspecies of turkey in the country, doesn't matter the species, they're all the same. It's a direct result of pressure. If you live in a place where almost nobody hunts turkeys and there's lots of turkeys around right now, you might be like, why does anybody, I mean, just go shoot one. I mean, they're stupid. They go walking around. They roost in the trees in your backyard because they're not pressured. When you hunt turkeys in a place with a lot of public land and there's a lot of hunters and there's a lot of pressure, turkeys are incredibly intelligent for a bird. And they have incredible hearing and incredible eyesight. And so what can often happen is, if you manage to call a gobbler in, that bird will come in, he's on full alert, he's looking for predators, meaning you, and something like a fox, okay? He's looking for girls to hook up with, but he's probably also on the lookout for other gobblers that may be bigger and tougher than he is. So he's on full alert. He's probably going to come in, instead of that nice pale blue head, he's going to have a very bright head. He's going to be on full alert. And he's looking for any movement, any sound, anything out of the ordinary. And if you make one mistake, that bird will disappear. And since you're sitting, 30, 40 yards away when that bird probably saw you, and you're using a full choke, and you're talking about a big bird, and you do need to hit head, neck, he's gone. He's gone. And they also get very good at figuring out, hey, that doesn't sound like it actually is a hen or something's up. And so turkey hunting can be extremely easy, moderate, or very difficult, not usually physically, but just from a standpoint tactically, depending on how much hunting pressure the birds where you're at are used to. I've been to places literally where you do what's called roosting a turkey. So here's a technique for hunting. You go out and roost, and what that means is you use calls or other sounds to try to get a bird to gobble back to you from the roost. That way you know where he is, and then the next day you sneak into a place relatively close to the roost, and you'll start calling maybe early, and you'll try to get him to come down right off the roost. Hey, I've already found me some girlfriend. I'm on my way in. It's a very successful technique when used properly, and it works. And people will use things to get these birds to gobble, like a turkey call, but they'll also use things like a crow call or an owl call, because turkeys hate crows and owls, and they will often, like a gobbler will get enraged and be basically like, F you, Mr. Hawk, F you, Mr. Crow, F you, Mr. Owl. So those sounds can trigger that turkey to gobble. I've seen places where I've literally seen dudes, because the turkeys are so not afraid of people, and they get so pissed off at noise in general, you slam a car door, which you normally wouldn't do when you're doing this, and it triggers the damn bird to gobble. And so how difficult this is directly proportional to how much hunting pressure those birds are used to. When we vacationed in Gatlinburg, and Smoky Mountain National Park is right there at the edge of Gatlinburg, and we went walking in the park in the mornings, you could almost walk up on the damn things. There's no hunting in there. It's a national park. They had no you drive up to them and look at them. They look at you like, hey, what's up, bitch? What are you doing? Try that on public hunting grounds or state forest or something like that in Pennsylvania. That's not happening. It's not happening. So I think Mike's completely right on you don't have to turn this into some Gucci level, you know, $5,000 worth of gear to hunt a turkey. Just know that if you're listening to this and you don't get it at all, again, they can be one of the most challenging game animals in the world, or they can be like shooting fish in a barrel. Again, it always has to do with what is the pressure like in the area. With that, let's hear about something totally different, shipmast locusts.
Hey there, Nick Ferguson here with a question on locusts from Michael. He says, Jack, been seeing videos on Facebook about adding a strain of black locusts called shipmast. They're supposed to grow straight and fast to be used for all types of things on a homestead like fence posts, fuel, hand tool handles, and if left for long enough, boards. Can Nick cover this species? It was developed in Hungary and Poland and is now available in the U.S. I've always liked black locusts we used to burn growing up in Ohio. Michael. All right. Shipmast locust is basically exactly the same in all respects as a regular black locust. The only real difference is it grows straighter and it's just easier to deal with from the standpoint of harvesting and, you know, building fence posts out of it. You don't have this kind of wonky looking tree that's growing crooked and, you know, having to deal with branches and stuff as much with a shipmast. So for things like posts and lumber, shipmast would be amazing. I don't really encourage it for things like tool handles. It's just like grain structure and stuff. It's not the best for that. And it's kind of heavy too. But, you know, locusts have been wildly popular in permaculture circles, and for good reason. The wood is absolutely fantastic, like we talked about, for fence posts. It's extremely rot-resistant. It's hard. If you were to process all the wood green, you mill it, it's planed, you join all the edges, you router the joints, all that kind of stuff, all while green, you could probably make some of the longest-lived wood flooring around, like generational, like hundreds of years. It's probably second only to Maclura palmifera, a.k.a. Osage orange, bodark, hedge apple, horse apple. You probably don't want to work that wood dried and cured, black locust. I've cut fence posts when I worked pipeline with a chainsaw, and it threw sparks like I was trying to cut through a steel pole. But, you know, pipeline is pipeline, and they want the fences out, so I literally burnt up two chainsaw chains just going through one post. So it's really sneaking hard once it's aged and cured. So I'm going to give you some anecdotal reports now. It's supposed to be really easy to split. Low smoke output, low sap resin content. So when it comes to firewood, fantastic on all of those fronts. And ranges from 26 to 29 MBTUs per cord, so that's million BTUs per cord, and around 2 tons per cord of dry weight, putting it at number 7 on the top firewood chart. For context, number 1 is Osage Orange at almost 33 BTUs, or million BTUs. All of these numbers I'm going to tell you are MBTUs. Number 9 is Honey Locust at 26.7. Number 11 is Mulberry at almost 26. Mulberry, honey locust, almost the same in BTUs. And black locust is 26 to 29. Mulberry, 26. So keep that in perspective. Number 12 is white oak at 25.7. Underneath mulberry. Number 35 is Doug fir at around 18. And for you northern folks, Doug fir is some premium stuff. So That should give you a little bit of context and understand where it ranks on the firewood chart. Now, mind you, those BTU charts are talking about splitting size firewood. So you're going to have lower numbers on coppiced wood, as it's going to have a higher sapwood to heartwood ratio, which drops your BTUs. Now, while I agree that Black Locust is fantastic, it truly is, and I like it for certain things, I'm growing shipmast, and I have some seedling selections that I'm waiting on that I hope will be even better than the shipmast you can currently find, so I like it. I have it on my property. I'm not the typical permaculture purple breather, though. I approach things from a different perspective. I'm a prepper, first and foremost. I think about things with a much bigger and wider set of concerns and data sets. I am looking at the likelihood that this extremely freaking fragile house of cards is going to tumble one day in my or my children's lifetime, and I don't want to see some kind of bad reset, but I think it's probably going to happen at some point. I hope it's a fantastic reset with benevolent, autonomous robots that lift humanity into prosperity and abundance. I think there's an excellent chance at another Great Depression, World War, or general bad stuff happening. And so I like to plan for those things. And when things get bad, I don't want to be the reason someone filled their property with nature's own caltrop production machines. Black Locust sends runners underground and spreads. It makes thorns that will break off an inch under your skin. And man, would it be terrible to be 2 years into some kind of bad event or depression and a child or grandchild gets sepsis from a puncture wound stepping on one of these branches that had thorns poking up and dies from sepsis. Like, that would be terrible. If times are good, I mean, it riddles tires in holes like a full auto wireless hole puncher does to a home intruder. I mean, it'll shred a tractor tire. So just consider down the road when you have to deal with the thorns that they're no joke. Great question. Keep them coming, guys. If you want to get on one of the consulting tours this summer, send me an email with consulting in the subject line to nick@homegrownliberty.com. And if you live in most of the South, I'm probably going to be hitting one of the states that you are in or adjacent to. So if you've emailed me in the past month or so and haven't gotten a response, I'm sorry, I've been super busy. I encourage you to bump me again. Your email might have gotten missed or spam foldered. There's a chance at that. It's just been a super busy month for us. Happy growing and do good things.
I'm going to just say on the whole shipmast label of the locust type, I think that it's a, I'm not going to say a scam, but maybe a bit oversold. I planted hundreds of locusts on this property, and well over 100 are still alive. Most of them have grown very tall and very straight with one main trunk. And the one thing I can say about them, and understand that this is magnified on my property because the soil is so thin before it hits rock. The way Nick put it is everything on your property grows like it's in a pot. Like, there's going to be some root binding. It can only go so deep. So what that actually causes more of a multi-trunk effect on a lot of trees. And so I do have quite a bit of that. But that is, even when you don't have my soils, like, what really happens is you get a lot of these, like, side slashes and all. If you grow your everyday, you know, that you can buy super cheap black locust seedlings, and as they grow, you simply prune off, you know, anything that would make a multi-trunk, so it grows a single trunk, this is going to go, and you plant it somewhere where it, you know, it's not super shaded in, doesn't have to lean, it's going to grow straight 95 times out of 100. So you plant 95 of them, you get 100 of them, you're going to plant 95 of them that grow really straight. And again, they won't have the multi-trunk if you don't let it happen. If you let it happen, you'll have a lot of it. I think all the shipmast locust is people go plant lots of black locusts, and then you cull all the locusts that don't grow the way you want them to, and you save seed and maybe do one more generation of that, and that's pretty much where you're at. And then you come up with a clever trademarked name. Because it, like Nick said, it may have been developed in Europe, but it's the same species as the native black locust in the United States. There's nothing patentable about it. This is a variety, not a specific cultivar or any sort of patent or anything like that. And anybody could do it, and anybody could recreate it. I just think it's a good idea to let people know that, so you don't like think you have to go out of your way to find this particular thing. If you can, and it's reasonably priced, it would shortcut a lot of culling, I would imagine. Anyway, next up, let's hear about Michael Faraday. Now, I bet you've heard of the Faraday cage, but do you know, as Paul Harvey used to say, the rest of the story? And with that, you know, let's hear from Dr. Bones himself with the rest of the story.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at altonfirstaid.com. Recently, Amy and I were roving in, of all places, the United Kingdom, when in a London park we came upon, to our surprise, a statue of someone that every member of the preparedness community should know, Michael Faraday. Yeah, the Faraday cage guy. So who was Michael Faraday? Michael Faraday was one of the most influential scientists of the 19th century, a self-taught English physicist, how do you self-teach physics, whose groundbreaking experiments laid the foundation for modern electromagnetism. Born into a poor family in South London, he began with little formal education as a bookbinder's apprentice, but he rose to prominence through his sheer curiosity. Faraday's key discoveries include electromagnetic induction, which is a process by which a changing magnetic field produces electric voltage in a conductor. This enabled the future development of electric generators, electric motors, electric transformers, things that we couldn't imagine modern society without. Also, he developed the laws of electrolysis, which led to the production of colloidal silver and other ionic solutions. How about that, preppers? He was the first also to formulate benzene. What's benzene? Benzene is a very important organic compound found in vast numbers of products today. Plastics, detergents, dyes, adhesives, drugs, pesticides, explosives, and more. It serves as a critical building block in the chemical industry. He also described the Faraday effect, where polarized light rotates in a magnetic field. Now, these breakthroughs and others by Faraday established the concept of the electromagnetic field and influenced future scientists to develop modern electrical engineering and physics. It was largely due to his efforts that electricity became practical for use in technology. Wow! Faraday's work directly led to the invention which bears his name and of which all preparedness folks should be aware, the Faraday cage. In the early 1830s, Faraday observed that excess electrical charge on a conductor always resides on its outer surface and has no effect on anything inside, thus protecting your modern electronics from EMPs. To test this observation dramatically, he constructed a 12-foot metal box covered in metal foil and mesh and insulated on glass supports. He fearlessly stepped inside and had high-voltage discharges from electrostatic generators strike the exterior of the container, which left him unharmed and proved that his cage completely shielded its interior. The year Faraday figured out how to protect yourself from electromagnetic pulses? 1836. His invention was called the Faraday cage and came to represent any enclosure made of conductive material like metal mesh, solid metal sheets, or foil that blocks external electromagnetic fields, radio waves, Wi-Fi, cell signals, and more, working by redistributing electric charges on its surface so that the interior remains shielded. The redistributed charges created an opposing internal field that exactly cancels the external one, resulting in a zero net electrical field inside. A good Faraday cage completely redirects or absorbs the damaging electromagnetic energy so it doesn't reach the devices inside. For static or low frequency fields, this cancellation is pretty effective. For electromagnetic waves like radio or microwaves and broadband transient bursts like EMPs, the effect holds as long as the mesh holes are smaller than the wavelength of the radiation, or foil is used to form a complete seal. Construction is important. It must be continuous with no big gaps nor conductive gasket on doors and seams. A loose aluminum foil wrap or a metal trash can with a loose lid, well, they may often provide some partial protection, but they can leak. Today, Faraday cages are everywhere as shields. Here are some common applications. Microwave ovens. The metal mesh in the door and the conductive enclosure trap the microwaves inside, preventing them from escaping while allowing you to see the food. Vehicles and aircraft. The metal body of a car or the conductive skin of an airplane acts as a Faraday cage, safely routing lightning strikes around occupants. If your plane gets hit by lightning, you're generally protected. Sensitive instruments. Faraday cages block external electrical noise like power line hum for more precise readings. Specialized tech. MRI scanner rooms use them to isolate radio signals. Shielded cables reduce interference in electronics. Larger shielded rooms are standards for classified government and military communications. And privacy and security. Devices exist that can attempt to read data from contactless credit cards while they're still inside your wallet or pocket. These are known as portable RFID or NFC skimmers, sometimes called electronic pickpocketing tools, and they can be countered with Faraday bags. Faraday bags are fabric pouches or wallets lined with conductive materials. They block skimming of credit cards or passports. They prevent cell phone tracking or remote wiping and protect against data theft in secure environments. So Faraday's humble cage, born from curiosity about electricity as a mysterious force, now safeguards our hyper-connected world. From preventing kitchen radiation leaks to protecting fighter jets, Faraday's work is a perfect example of how a simple principle discovered long ago continues to power and protect everything from power grids to personal privacy. Without Michael Faraday's experiments, our electrified modern life and the very devices we rely on simply wouldn't exist. This is Joe Alden, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, don't forget to check out our entire line of essential books, quality medical kits, and individual supplies at store.doomandbloom.net or AltonFirstAid.com. You'll be glad you did.
You guys, I may reach out to Bones. I give him shit sometimes and call him Dr. Boomer or whatever. That's just because he's a good friend and I love him. And that's what dudes do is we mess with each other when we really like each other. But he's actually, I've had a lot of discussions with him. He and his wife, Amy, are good friends of myself and Dorothy. And whenever we travel to Florida, we always make sure to spend some time with them. And I've had some deep intellectual discussions with Bones. And, you know, most doctors are smart people. They're relatively high IQ, even though we come down on the medical industry with good reason at times. The doctors themselves, people that can get through, could get through medical school when Bones did, when standards were high, extremely intelligent. But Bones is intelligent among the intelligent, all right? He's at that elite level. And we've had some deep intellectual conversations about things well outside the scope of medicine because, well, at least I can hold my own there. And we may just reach out to him for more things like this. I found that to be really interesting and not something we generally would expect from the MD on the panel. Anyway, let's now talk about dogs with Joel Riles. And this is a common thing. My dog listens. It's obedient. It does all the things. And then you take the dog to the park, and there's other dogs and people and squirrels and kids and noises and people slamming doors, and the dog doesn't listen at all. Joel will talk about how to deal with that.
Hello, everyone. This is Joel with Fortress Canine and Canine Academy coming back at you again with another Expert Counsel segment. Today's question comes from Chris. And Chris has a dog that obeys pretty much awesome inside their home and in a controlled environment. It sits when he asks, it lays down when he asks, it stays where it's supposed to, but as soon as he gets any kind of distraction or he tries to go out in public, he loses it all. The dog pulls on the leash, it ignores his commands, and it gets distracted by people and dogs and squirrels and deer and all sorts of other things. So Chris asks, how do I get my dog to be obedient even in public when there's lots of distractions? And the simple answer is this: you need discipline. The distractions are real, but that's not the problem. The problem is the dog has not been trained to do what it's supposed to do, even when it doesn't want to. And that's the definition of discipline: doing what you have to, even when you don't want to. If the dog wants to go play with another dog, or run away from a loud noise, or wants to chase something, but it still obeys, that's discipline. And that's what needs to be trained. Now, this does start in a controlled environment. But instead of always making everything easy for the dog, you need to start making them somewhat uncomfortable. So you might take a dog and put them in a down, which we call a plutz, on a hard surface and make them stay in a very strict position. Or you can limit their movement by putting them on a beam that's 8 or 10 inches wide, making them lay down on it and stay there for extended periods of time. Now you're starting to require the dog to focus. And if they break the position, you put them back and start all over again. What you're doing is you're building a habit of staying disciplined and staying in obedience even when they don't want to. Once the dog has discipline in a controlled environment, then you can begin introducing the distractions. But now you're going to make the position easier. So instead of having them lay in an uncomfortable position, you might just have them sit at your side on a sidewalk or in the grass. And every time you make the environment a little bit harder. So you're going to want to start in a place where it's relatively quiet and there's mild distractions, maybe people and dogs walking around at a distance. And then as the dog does well there, you begin adding more and more crowds, more noise, more distractions, like walking around outside the fence of a dog park would be a really high level of distraction. And you gradually just build it to more and more and more distractions and things that are going to cause the dog to want to break obedience. The key here is progression. You want to just take progressive steps, always making a little bit more progress with each training session. Now, when this is done correctly, your results are going to be very clear. You should be able to walk around in pretty much any environment, and even if your dog's slightly distracted or mildly stressed, they should stay in obedience with you and listen to your voice. The other thing that's going to happen throughout this process is they're going to tune their ears to your voice so that they listen to you even when other things are going on around them. And this doesn't mean that the dog doesn't have to deal with actual distractions. It just means that the dog learns that it has to stay focused on you, stay in its obedience, and pay close attention to your verbal commands. There's always going to be some level of distraction or some level of stress that's going to cause your dog to break obedience. But the idea is we want to build up that something that's more than what we would normally encounter in our daily lives so that when we do encounter those things, it's no big deal for the dog. And here's another thing people often overlook. Sometimes the distraction isn't with the dog, it's with the handler. A lot of times the environment is affecting you, and you become distracted, and then you stop communicating clearly with the dog, you start tensing up on the lead and giving a tight lead which confuses them. You want to maintain a loose lead, you use corrections when necessary, you communicate clearly. Don't allow your environment to distract you from handling your dog until both of you can move smoothly in pretty much any environment that you're going to normally face. If you can't walk your dog calmly down the sidewalk in the morning with neighbors walking around with their dogs, you're definitely not ready to go out into a high stress or super crowded environment that's really noisy. You gotta build up to it. You just build up step by step, and when you do this, you'll not only have a dog that's obedient, but you'll have a dog handler team that can move in almost any environment very smoothly and efficiently. So I hope this was helpful for you. If you'd like more information learning how to train your own dog, check out Canine Academy by going to thesurvivalpodcast.com and clicking on the Canine Academy banner and check out the courses that we have there available. And if you're looking for a working line puppy or a fully trained companion or protection dog, check out fortresscanine.com, click on the consult button, send us a message, and I'll reach out to you. Until next time, remember to train hard and stay safe.
So here's a fundamental when it comes to training in general, and it doesn't matter if it's a dog or a person or anything. If you're talking about training to do something that is in some way more difficult, so I'm going to take one thing away from this. It'd be like training a tree by tying and manipulating it, right? That's not what I mean. So any other version of training, a moving living being that can think in some way, like a dog does, it's basically the same commonality in all forms of training. To become better, you have to make the thing you're doing harder. It's that simple. And only by making it harder can you become better. So let's think of it from a standpoint of weight training and becoming stronger. If you started doing a bench press as one of your primary exercises, along with maybe some deadlifts and reps and sets for a certain number of exercises you do so many days a week, and you did that, and you got into a position where you were working out with a weight that really challenged you, okay? And you kept doing it for months until you got stronger and you got better technique and you got better all around to the point where you can just move through that workout now. If you don't change something, you'll plateau and you won't get any better. You'll have to do more reps, right? Like, I'm going to say, like, it's not just add weight. Add weight's the easy answer, but you could do things like, you could do more sets, more reps per set, right? Less rest between sets. All of those things would change something about it, as would adding weight. But in some way, shape, or form, you have to make what you're doing or what you're making the thing you're doing, you're requiring the thing you're training do harder. So if you want the dog to be more obedient in situations where there's distractions, you have to begin to introduce distractions. If you want to make somebody able to jump higher over a hurdle, you have to raise the bar. You have to push to the edge of failure and a little bit past, and then you keep executing until that edge becomes the new normal, and then you go to the next edge. And it won't ever, that's the beauty of this, it's not just about, like, that will always be how to make your dog better, but it will always be how to make anything you're doing from a training standpoint better. You stick with safety, right? So with lifting weights, proper form, not lifting too much, etc., having spotters, whatever it is. With a dog, you make sure you have a means of correction. The dog can't run away and get hit by a car or kill somebody else's other animal or something like that. You create a safety mechanism in place. And you don't go too far too fast, but you always have to push past the edge. It won't matter if you're teaching something academically, you go to more complicated math problems, just a little bit more complicated than that which was mastered, the person becomes more adept at mathematics. See what I mean? It doesn't matter. Shooting, you make the target a little smaller, right? You give the time and the cadence between shots a little less time. You move back a little bit further in distance, right? You use a rifle that doesn't have quite as much reach as the one that you're using now. In some way, you jog before you shoot. In some way, you increase the difficulty, and you continue to execute at that difficulty level until that difficulty level is mastered, and then you increase it again. I just thought that would be an interesting add-on to Joel's excellent piece right there. Now let's hear from Jesse Markowitz on what's in your wallet. And I mean, in your Bitcoin wallet. I'll give you a clue. It's not your Bitcoin. How does that work? Jesse will explain it.
Hi, this is Jesse Markowitz with YourPersonalBitcoinAssistant.com. Today's question came up in a conversation I had with some friends. As we were talking, it occurred to me that there might be a lot of people out there who think they know the answer, but are actually wrong. There's a quote often attributed to Mark Twain. It's not what you don't know that gets you. It's what you know that ain't so that gets you. So the question is, where is your Bitcoin stored? Most people answer, in my wallet. There may be variations such as Sparrow wallet on my computer, Blue wallet on my phone, or on my hardware wallet. Folks are confident they know the answer, but it just ain't so. Your Bitcoin does not live in your wallet. It never did. Bitcoin lives on the Bitcoin blockchain, which is the public ledger distributed across thousands of computers around the world. Every transaction ever made is recorded there, publicly, permanently. When someone sends you Bitcoin, what actually happens is that a record is written to that public ledger saying, this amount of Bitcoin now belongs to this address. No coins physically move anywhere. Nothing gets downloaded to your phone or your computer. The blockchain just says who owns what. Imagine a huge room filled with safety deposit boxes. All of the boxes are clear and have a box number, a slot to add things, and a lock. Anyone can look at any box and see what's in there. They can add to the box but not take anything out unless they have the key to the lock. The Bitcoin ledger is like that. All of the address boxes are public and clear. Anyone can see all the transactions and what the Bitcoin balance is. You can send Bitcoin to any address, but you can't spend it. You can't take things out unless you have that private key. Bitcoin explorers such as mempool.space let you browse and search the public blockchain and see the details of any transaction or address. Take some time, go look up any Bitcoin address and see for yourself. Follow the transactions, see where it came from. So, if your Bitcoin is on the blockchain, what's in the wallet? A wallet is a bit of a misleading name. Your wallet in your purse or back pocket holds physical cash. A Bitcoin wallet does not hold Bitcoin. What it holds are keys, specifically the private keys that control Bitcoin addresses. Let's talk a bit about how wallets work. your Bitcoin wallet has two critical functions. It generates and stores your private keys securely, and it acts as a signing device using your private key to digitally sign a transaction. Wallet software on your phone or computer can watch the blockchain for all the addresses tied to your keys, add up the balances across all of them, and show you one combined total. It can also give you an easy interface to build the transaction to send your Bitcoin, and after the transaction is signed, broadcast that transaction to the Bitcoin network. It can also work with a hardware wallet for the key storage and signing functions. A hardware wallet is a small dedicated physical device, something like a USB drive, specifically designed to generate and store your private keys and to sign transactions. When you want to send Bitcoin, you connect it to an app or program running on your computer or phone. That software creates the transaction. The transaction is signed on the hardware wallet device. Then the signed transaction is broadcast to the network by the app or program. Your private key never leaves the hardware wallet. It's not exposed to your computer or to the internet. You may have heard of Trezor and ColdCard. These are popular hardware wallets, and there are other companies that also make hardware wallets as well. Some wallets are referred to as hot wallets. This refers to any wallet that is connected to the internet, your phone wallet app, a desktop wallet on your laptop, the wallet built into a website or exchange. These wallets manage the keys within their own program, not with a hardware wallet. Hot wallets are convenient. They make it easy to send and receive Bitcoin quickly. The trade-off is being connected to the internet means more exposure to hackers, to malware, and other attacks. You may also hear the term cold storage. That just means keeping a wallet completely offline. A private key or seed phrase written down and stored securely, never connected to the internet, that's cold storage. Hardware wallets are the most practical form of cold storage for most people. For small amounts you're actively spending, hot wallet on your phone is fine. However, for significant amounts that you want to hold long term, cold storage is the right answer. So, when it comes to Bitcoin, you don't really need to protect your Bitcoin. You need to protect your Bitcoin keys. If you lose your private key, your Bitcoin is not gone from the blockchain. It's still sitting there on that public ledger in that address. But without the key, nobody can touch it. Not you, not anyone. It's locked away. This is why backing up your wallet is so important, and why understanding what you are backing up matters. When you set up most wallets, you are given a seed phrase, usually a list of 12 or 24 words. That seed phrase can regenerate your private keys on any compatible wallet software or device. Most wallets follow the same open standard, so your seed phrase is not locked to one app or one brand. That seed phrase is your backup. Protect it like the most important thing you own, because when it comes to your Bitcoin, it is. If someone else gets your seed phrase, they have your keys, and they have access to your Bitcoin. Period. Everything we've talked about assumes that you hold your own keys, but there's a whole category of wallets where you do not. These are called custodial wallets. When you buy Bitcoin on Coinbase, Kraken, or most exchanges, your Bitcoin is held in a custodial wallet. The exchange holds the private keys. They are the custodian. You have an account with them that says that they owe you a certain amount of Bitcoin. As I've mentioned before in other segments, that's not the same as actually owning Bitcoin itself. It's an IOU. The exchange could freeze your account. They could go bankrupt, as FTX did, and you would be in line with other creditors. Not your keys, not your coins. Like everything in life, there are trade-offs. With a custodial wallet, you have less control, but you get the ability for customer support to help you out if you forget your password or otherwise lose access to your account. When you hold Bitcoin in wallets you control, you are solely responsible for your private keys. While no one can take them away from you, no one can help you if you lose them. That balance of control versus convenience is something every Bitcoin holder needs to think through deliberately, not just stumble into by default. So now you know how to answer when someone asks you, "What's in your wallet?" This has been Jesse Markowitz from YourPersonalBitcoinAssistant.com. If you haven't taken the time to think about how your Bitcoin keys are stored, protected, and backed up, do so now. Understand your Bitcoin risks. Keep the questions coming in. I always enjoy answering these.
A great segment by Jesse, and I don't need to rehash any of it. I just want to talk about, this is why you don't technically ever own Bitcoin. What you have is control of Bitcoin. And it's an interesting thing because Bitcoin, when deeply examined, brings your mindset up to that of the wealthy versus the poor and the blue collar and the downtrodden. You will think more like a wealthy person because you have to truly dissect the mechanics of wealth and value and game theory and a ton of other things and what a real asset really is. But one of the tenets of the rich, and the reason I bring this up, is the rich don't seek necessarily to own things. They like owning things, but not all things. They seek control. And so I'd rather control a thing than own it in many ways, because I have more leverage that way. And it's not the same thing with Bitcoin, but it's kind of a way to think about it. You don't really own it. You control it with a signing device. That's what a wallet really is. It is a way to have these complicated numbers that all have to match, always match, in a very user-friendly way. It is not a wallet. It's actually a terrible name. The right term for it would be a signing device. It lets you sign transactions on the blockchain. But the way that I've always tried to explain this to make it a little bit more clear with something totally familiar. Let's imagine you set up, you know, a camera at your door, like a Ring camera, or I don't care what brand it is, anything like that. And when you get that camera and you install it, it comes with an app. You install that app on your phone, and then you sync it up. And now you can pull up your phone, and you can look at your phone and see who's at your front door and what's going on. And in the case of Ring, you can even communicate with them, like, just leave the package, I see you, or you're in real trouble now, you better run away because the police have been notified, or whatever else it is, right, whatever selling point they use. But when you're looking at that, and, you know, Bill from Amazon is putting the package on your porch, you see your porch. And you see Bill, and you see the package, all at the same time. Which of those things is in your phone? Not on your phone, in your phone. Is Bill, your package, or your porch in your phone? The answer is no. Bill is on your porch is at the front of your house, right? Your package is there too, and geographically it's wherever the hell in the world your house is. And if you happen to be at work sitting in the break room and you picked up your phone to check on things when you saw Bill from Amazon delivering your package, even though you're at work 25 miles away and you see Bill on your phone, Bill's not in your phone. He's on your phone. You see a representation of Bill. And you can even interact with that representation, like signing a transaction or seeing that you now control a specific amount of Bitcoin that Bill sent to you if that was going a different way. And so just like a picture from a remote camera isn't in your phone, Bitcoin isn't in your wallet. It allows you to access it. So hopefully that makes it a little more clear, if anything wasn't clear, in the great segment that Jesse just did. So now let's talk about this. This is a question that came in. I found this to be a really interesting question because I would have never even thought to talk about it. So let me just read the email that came in. This is from Larry. And Larry said, I saw you post a Telegram course a day ago. And I had heard of Telegram, but never looked at it over the years. I did and decided it might be a good avenue for me right now to do some online teaching. Can you give me some heads-up pointers or tips when it comes to using Telegram? Facebook linked to a post about the course I want to work up. I think I'm capable of making a course for educators who all have had some computer training and some code training, but do not understand the overall big picture and landscape behind software engineering. The technology is layered like an onion on top. I guess I don't really need to read much more of that. This is going into his idea for teaching course. Other than I can say, this might work well for you, Larry. So Telegram is not an educational platform, and it's not a Telegram course. I came up with an educational program, and we're using Telegram as a means to deliver it. So let's start off with that. Telegram is powerful. It's a very useful tool. And when you use it for something like this, you probably won't have very much problem with spammers coming in and disrupting things, because you can set it up and should set it up as a private group. And that way they can't find it. It's by invitation only. And that'll make things a lot better. We run public groups for the community on Telegram where we do deal with that. But we've got some really awesome folks that moderate those groups. And they have developed our own custom bot technology that literally bans people who are a problem before the moderators even get to it. It's really cool, but you won't need to worry about that. But effectively, what Telegram is text messaging. But you can also send things like files and videos and stuff like that and photos with them as well. and have fun playing around with GIFs as well, or GIFs, depending on how you choose to say it. So that's what it really is. It's basically text messaging in an open, or not really an open source, but a publicly available application. And it does allow for things like end-to-end encrypted messaging, but that only happens when you're talking to one person. Using encrypted messaging in a group, unless you actually know, like, first name basis, in real life, every party in the group, doesn't really make a lot of sense anyway. And, of course, for a class, you wouldn't really need that. And so, but let me tell you how we use it and why we use it. So our class for AI is the one we use it for. It's the only class I've ever done with Telegram up to this point, even though I've done a lot of other classes. This class is designed for the whole group, the student body, to move through together with the ability to help each other and communicate during the class. What you're describing with a class that is about coding seems like that might be a great way to go. And no one that's going to take a class like that's going to have a hard time using Telegram. My gut is that this type of people might be more used to using something like Slack, which you could do this as well. But to me, Telegram is excellent for this purpose because more than half of people that use smartphones and technology probably have Telegram anyway. So they already have it. Within my community, that's probably higher because we actively promote communities on Telegram. So very, very high. Unlike Facebook, you really maintain a ton of control. So there's also, with Telegram, there's two distinctively different ways to deliver content across Telegram. There are what's called groups, and there's what's called a channel. And I have both of those for the TSP community that is different than what we do for the school. So the channel is basically the Survival Podcast broadcast channel. And so every day as I put out content, I announce like when a live is going to be, I post the item of the day, a new episode is available, anything like that. Individually, I put that all across social media and I just take the same post and I drop it in the Telegram channel. That is basically giving me the ability to send a text message, a rich text message too, sometimes video, image, whatever, to anybody in the community that wants to follow me without somebody filtering it. Like when I put it on X, you could have followed me for the last 10 years and you may never see it, even if you're on X all the time. If you keep the Telegram app on your phone and you check it, you will always get my communication. So that's how we use that. That's one directional. That would be point to multipoint. I put in one message. If I have 5,000 followers, it goes to 5,000 people. Point to multipoint. Okay. Then you have a group. A group is for discussion, like a community forum, except in a text message app. It's like a giant group text message. And so it's multipoint to multipoint, right? It's actually point to multipoint and back, right? It's not unidirectional. So the channels point to multipoint one way, where the group is point to multipoint, but you can respond directly back. And you can link a group to a channel. There's a reason I'm explaining all this with using it for an educational platform. Because when we set it up for education, we do both. We set up, you know, chat for GPT, round 4 is what we just set up. We set up a channel and we set up a group. Now, what happens when you link the two? When I post something to my channel, it automatically goes to the associated group. So, for instance, with the Survival Podcast audience, and you can join either of these if you want to. You can go to the website, survivalpodcast.com, click on Get Social, you'll find links to both the group and the channel. When I post to the channel, everybody in the channel gets it, but if you're just in the channel, all you see is what I post. If you're in the group, you see what everybody posts, plus what I post to the channel, and if you respond to what I posted from the channel, I'll see it in the channel and in the group, both. And I can see then, I made this one post and 5 people responded to it. It's a very organized way for me to see that, okay? So that's how it works, and that's how it was designed to work for exactly the way I just described it, use it. Basically a brand that gives its followers the ability to follow just the brand or communicate with the rest of the community. Because some people don't want to communicate with the rest of the community. They don't want 1,000 messages. They just want to hear from me. And that either way is fine. For a program like our ChatGPT course, this is a perfect setup. What it allows me to do, and this is, let me tell you how the course worked, because it sounds like you're not familiar with the course itself. Maybe you don't listen as much as others maybe do. So what happens is all the people that came into this course on Monday morning, the course will start on day one. I will make a post, and that post will be a video for that day, kind of getting you ready for it, kind of priming the pump. And then there'll be a document, and that document will have your prompts and instructions for the day. I will put that in the channel. The channel will immediately move it into the group where there's 100 students. Those 100 students now receive their instructions. That usually happens with my courses about 8 o'clock in the morning Central Time. I try to get them out early so people have all day to work on them. Some people will immediately go to work. Some people will start working on them in the middle of the day. Some will do it after work in the evening at home, whenever they decide they have time. But the idea is that you're trying to get people to all do their daily work daily at the same speed as everybody else in the class. Because we're doing it in that environment, all the students now, when they have questions and they ask a question, it's not just me or Tom answering it, other students can share their answers and their ideas and their thoughts. So it's like a true class in that there's, we're not saying, hey, don't talk to your classmate. Please talk to your classmate. We're not saying, don't look at your classmate's work. Please look at your classmate's work. Please learn from it. This is actually interactive learning that we're doing. So everybody share. We want everybody to succeed, get the most out of this. We're not trying to test you. We're trying to inform you with knowledge and power and the ability to act. This is real education that we're doing with this. By doing it, though, with the mirror of the channel and the group, I don't post anything to that channel except things that are like top-level class information, like here's today's lesson, here's today's video, or here's today's bonus, okay? Or here's something I picked up today that the class can use in their assignment. Here's a question somebody asked and my answer to it. What that means, though, is that you, as a class member, will, if you do what we tell you to, you'll follow both. And so if you finally have time at 4 o'clock in the afternoon when you're done with work to work on your prompts for the day, you don't have to dig through a mile of people communicating with each other. You can go right to the channel and see only the stuff that was assigned to you by the instructors. And this is an incredibly powerful way to do things because I'm not worried that the person that didn't get their instructions till 2 o'clock and the person that didn't get their instructions till 7 o'clock at night can't find it because it's buried. It's very easy to find. The most recent posts by the instructor in the channel are your work for the day, and everything else is communication and collaboration. We even tell students, after you're done with your chat, if it went really well, if it's really an interesting thing you'd like to share, make a document out of it. Don't cut and paste the whole damn thing and hog up the window, right, with a mile of text. Make a document and then post up, say, this is my chat today, here's what happened, and attach the document. And that way students can look at each other's work and derive things from it. And when students come up with things that aren't even in the curriculum, like they go off on side quests, they find this really cool thing, and they bring it back, they can share it with other students. And when a student's like, I'm really having trouble with this, and another student's like, I had the same problem, but here's what I did to fix it, they can share that information. And I find it to be one of the most incredibly useful tools to educate people that I have ever seen in my life, but only if you truly have a class environment where the whole group is working in the same time frame. And so we do this over a 40-day period. I'm going to be honest with you about what happens. Day one, everybody's working. Day five, everybody's working. Day 14, almost everybody's still working. People are excited. People are really moving along. As the class gets longer and people get a little bit further behind, you start to see drift. And I'm going to say 60 to 70% complete all the work to the very end and finish on time with the class. And I have to be at peace with that and realize that, like, You paid for the class. It's your choice how quickly you move through it. If you decide to take a break, if you decide I don't want to complete it or whatever, I have to be okay with that. I don't like it. When I take somebody's money and I promise to give them something, I really feel like my obligation is to give it to them. And when I talk to people about this, they say, well, you did. You delivered exactly what you promised. Yeah, but I did it for a reason. It wasn't just so I could say, here's a document, give me money. I did it to empower them. And so I really am passionately, emotionally and passionately involved in the success of students of my work, not just the fact that they're happy with their purchase. That's really important to me. But in the end, a person's going to do what a person's going to do. And so the one thing I would say to you, Larry, is this will work for you if you can get a big enough group committed to what you're teaching all at the same time. If you're going to use it more for like one-on-one student interaction, it's text messaging. And it's not a bad platform to use for it. And it has a lot of powerful components to it. And you can still have class, students able to communicate in like a group environment, but it won't be as effective, I think, as leading them through the process. But then this is the coup de grace. This is what we do as the final thing for all this. We have a group called ChatGPT Alum, something like that. Whatever name Tom came up with it, TSPC ChatGPT Alumni. It's a private invitation-only group, and every student who graduates the course, takes the course all the way to the end, is then told at the end, hey, here's this new place that you can join. And if they join it, they are now in a group with other people who have completed all the training, and they have access to all future courses. Not if we do a new course. Like when we do round 4, the people that took round 1, 2, or 3 all have that. They can take it again. They can participate in the parts they want. They can simply observe the results of the other students. If I put in a bonus that wasn't in a prior round, they have access to the bonus. When I come up with a new video to explain something, they have access to that video. So by doing it in multiple rounds, we're actually adding value from the standpoint of the earlier you get in, the more you get long term. And so you need to be thinking about all of that in your marketing as well. So if you have a course you're going to come up with, you kind of see it as a course that like somebody will buy it today, and then maybe I'll sell 2 next week, and then next month I'll sell 4 more, and then a week later I'll sell 1, and then 2 weeks later maybe I sell 3. It may not really work well. If you have enough of a following that you can put out a course and set a sale date and then a launch date for the course with your group understanding it, it is phenomenal. Because I have always found one of the biggest misconceptions of organized education, it is bad for students to share work with each other. I understand why we do it for things like memorizing your times tables and stuff like that. That makes sense to me. I get it. I think everybody should be able to do basic mathematics. I think there are certain things that should be committed to memory so they form a base level of knowledge. And that people should walk around with a base level of knowledge. I'm not objecting to that. I'm saying that at a point, and it's probably much earlier than we seem to believe that it is. You know, again, by the time you know things with mathematics, like order of operations, greater than, less than, rounding, estimation in your times, addition, subtraction, division tables, it's probably time to start letting everybody work together. Because people learn by doing, and they'll do it if it's easier to do it, if they can learn from somebody else, and they can ask somebody else, and they can get a different explanation, they probably will. And, you know, what is education supposed to prepare people for? The real world. When you're in an office environment, right, as real world as it gets, with a, you know, your conventional white-collar job, everything's about working as a team. You don't know something, you go to the team member that knows the thing. You ask for help and guidance. You go to your boss and say, hey, I'm thinking about this initiative you gave me. Here's an idea I have for it. What do you think about it? And they should, if they're a good leader, help you sharpen it. Everything we do in the quote-unquote real freaking world is collaborative. Even if we're doing something highly guarded, highly secret, you know, like something that we don't want the competition to get, internally we're still being collaborative with it. So we should educate people to work the way that they're going to work, and that is through collaboration. And that is what makes Telegram, when used properly and in the right scenario, an amazing tool for education. So hopefully that, I hope that just, if one person in this audience, that jogs something in your head and you create something because of it, that'll be worth the 18 minutes of this segment. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed this week's programming. We had a pretty good week. We started out with a show that was very well received. When we talked about the 10 traits of this decade's winners this week, if you didn't catch that one, you may want to go catch it. We had a typical kind of melee, crazy day with John and Nicole on our first Tuesday coffee chat. Those come every first Tuesday, obviously. And then yesterday, I thought it was a fantastic interview with Hans Hagman on transforming boys into anti-fragile men and the work that he has done and continues to do with at-risk youth, and including some that are already in the penitentiary system, is incredibly important work. I found that to be one of the most intellectually inspirational discussions I've had with anybody in a very long time. So we had a great week, and I hope you enjoyed this this show today with the experts and my thoughts on Telegram and everything else. And if you did, make sure you check in with us next week. We'll have a whole new lineup of shows for you. If you're new around here and you're not a subscriber and you just caught this somehow, please subscribe. If you're already a subscriber but you're not on the Daily Mail or the Telegram channel, I recommend you do one of those. If you do one of those, you will miss nothing that I put out unless you choose to. And you can stop listening or paying attention anytime you want to. I am going to suggest for many of you, though, that you might want to consider the Telegram channel and the Daily Mail. Here's why. The Daily Mail is kind of like a backup. At the end of the day, when I'm done, when I sign off in a few minutes from now, while the show's editing, I'll put together a little text file, I'll drop it in AWeber, and when the show's live, I'll hit send, it'll say, here's today's item of the day, here's what's going on, here's today's show, stuff like that. And you'll get one email a day, Monday through Thursday. If you're on the Telegram channel, those alerts come out as they happen. Why would you care? Well, one would be if you like catching, we don't do lives on the expert panel show, but the other shows every week we do live. I put out at least an hour, sometimes 2 hours, sometimes even earlier before a live, when the live will be and what it's about. That way you could actually catch a live. When I put out item of the day, a lot of times it doesn't matter, but when they're deals of the day, when they're special sale prices, etc., when they're really good deals, there has been way more than one time, I'm not saying once or twice, way more than one time, that I have found some sort of stellar deal, and by the time the show was published, the deal was gone. Here's an example. One time I found this incredibly good deal on a plasma cutting tool. This is like your lower end plasma cutter, but it was like a $260, $270 plasma cutter. It's about as cheap as they get. It somehow ended up on sale for $88. I'm going to tell you, you could have bought this thing, left it in the box, went down to the pawn shop and got $140 for it. It would have been that, put $60 in your pocket. You could have bought two of them and kept one. You'd have bought three of them, sold two to the pawn shop, and got yours for free. That's how good this deal was. And I knew the minute I looked at it, somebody that works for that company effed up. But they're going to have to eat it. So I bought one before I put it out, and I put it out. I sold almost 100 of them. In fact, I believe it was 117 of them before somebody somewhere got their ass chewed out, and the price went back to normal. It did not make it to me recording the show, let alone me publishing the show and sending out the Daily Mail. So if you are interested in things like the lives or when something comes up that's time-based and time-sensitive, get on the Telegram group or channel or both. It's up to you. Again, if you get on the channel, you'll only hear from me. You won't have all the crosstalk of all the rest of the community. We also have Telegram groups for special communities, not just educational, but like everybody that has ever been here to a workshop has access to a Telegram that is only for people who have been to TSB workshops. It's a fun platform, so I encourage you to think about ways that you can leverage it in your business or community as well. With that, have a great weekend. I will be back on Monday with another Just Jack show, and we'll do another week all over again.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.